All right. Good morning, everybody. Time for us to get started. We're in Joshua chapter 11. And last week, make sure this, yeah, that's on. Last week we finished up with this great threat to Israel at the beginning of chapter 11. Jabin, the king of Hazor, is decided to form an even bigger coalition, one that is probably equal in number to Israel's strength. It's numbered like the sand of the sea. And on top of that, they also have a lot of cavalry and chariots. And we talked about what a huge threat the chariot was in ancient warfare. And then we just kind of left it on the cliffhanger there. How is this battle going to turn out? So let's begin in verse 6, Joshua 11, verse 6. And the Lord said to Joshua, "Do not be afraid of them, for tomorrow at this time I will give over all of them slain to Israel. You shall hamstring their horses and burn their chariots with fire." So Joshua and all his warriors came suddenly against them by the waters of Merom and fell upon them. And the Lord gave them into the hand of Israel, who struck them and chased them as far as Great Sidon and Mesrepoth-Maim, and eastward as far as the valley of Mizpah. And they struck them until he left none standing. Left none remaining. And Joshua did to them just as the Lord said to him. He hamstrung their horses and burned their chariots with fire. All right, so the Lord speaks to Joshua. And as we've seen him do throughout the book, he tells Joshua not to be afraid, that he's going to give Israel the victory. In fact, Israel will defeat the coalition in a day's time. Right, this is going to be a quick battle. It's not going to be difficult. It is going to be such a total victory that they are going to hamstring the enemy horses and burn the enemy chariots with fire. Now, the previous generation of Israel probably would have met a message like that with incredulity, right? You mean to tell me that we're going to go toe-to-toe with horses and chariots, and we're going to win? But that's precisely what the Lord tells Joshua. And you don't see any inkling of that kind of doubt in this generation. And just think about what the Lord is promising them. You know, imagine yourself staring down a horse, right? You're going to take on a horse in, you know, hand-to-hand combat, essentially. I mean, you've got your spear or your sword, and how much chance do you think you personally have against a horse, right? I've had family members, you know, trampled by livestock, and generally you do not fare too well against an animal that size. And yet that's what the Lord promises Israel, and they go in and they do exactly as the Lord says. Right? In fact, you know, I kind of spent a lot of time at the end of last week building up the threat that's presented in the first five verses. But how seriously does the text take that threat? How much time does the text spend on dealing with that threat? Like, none at all. Like in the four verses that we just read, this battle against the Northern Coalition is done. Like, the army is defeated. The text doesn't take this battle seriously at all. The battle's just done. Israel wins. And they hamstring the horses, and they burn the chariots with fire, and that's it. It's interesting to me. It's kind of ironic. This is probably the biggest single battle that Israel engages in the book of Joshua, and it receives the shortest description of any of the battles that Israel is engaged in. And you know which one got the longest description? Ai. which takes up, you know, two battles over the course of two chapters. You remember what the spies said about Ai? They told Joshua, oh, Ai is little. Don't even worry. We don't want to wear everybody out by having them go to Ai. So don't even send the whole army. Just send a couple of thousand men there, and that'll be fine. Right? So this threat that looked really, really minimal in Israel's eyes turned out to be the biggest threat that took them the longest time to deal with. And then what looks, again, from a worldly perspective, what looks to be the greatest threat to Israel, again, as far as the text presents it to us, is probably the most inconsequential thing that we've read in the book so far. It goes to show that ultimately the distinguishing factor is not how big the enemy's army is, or how well provisioned, or if they have horses or chariots. What it ultimately comes down to is the Lord with Israel or not? If the Lord is with Israel, then no enemy can stand before them. Right? If Israel is obedient to the Lord, nobody can stand against them. But if Israel is disobedient, and if the Lord is not with Israel, then they cannot win, no matter how inconsequential the threat. All right, so for all that buildup, that's the end of that battle. Any questions or comments about that before we continue to the next bit of text? Okay?
They had a million-man army that our camp was close to have gotten together. And the United States, well, we were all worried that we were not able to build up enough people to take on an army that size. Well, we got several, you know, foreign countries that are pre-rivers in the coalition. And we built up around 600,000 of the line. We went against them anyway. What we found out is that most of that million man army were unexpected. And we just totally wiped them out. We're quick and easy. Just, you know, one day is what we've done. And so it kind of gives me the idea that, you know, just because you've got a big army doesn't mean that you've got the best army.
There might be something to that, although the way that this text presents it, it's like, imagine if Saddam Hussein not only had that many men, but also had all of the armor divisions that Norman Schwarzkopf took against Iraq. Imagine that the tables were turned on that. That instead of us having all of the armor, you know, the tanks and the armored vehicles and the things that we used to storm up to Baghdad. But imagine if they had our armor and we were stuck with their equipment.
But we had the air.
Right.
The superiority was the air.
Right. So what I'm saying is that from an ancient perspective, all of the superiority, like the stuff that we think of in terms of like, yeah, aircraft carriers and bombers, all of this high-tech stuff that always gives us the edge in our fights, the coalition of the nations had that. Israel didn't. Israel's practically fighting with sticks. Right? Maybe the closer comparison would be something like the American Revolution or some other kind of guerrilla war where the outsized, outgunned, out-provisioned force still comes out victorious. Solomon is there. Yeah, it's the same kind of narrative thing. Like you've got this, nobody would expect to go up against Goliath. This guy's, you know, besides outweighing you like five times over, he's got an insanely long reach. You're not even gonna get close to him, and you're gonna be chopped in half. And yet, David, this young guy, is able to take on Goliath. Again, it is the kind of story that we read very often. So, I think that's a good comparison. All right.
I read another poem along those lines. And I was introduced to a total other thing that Saul to think that Goliath was the big guy, the champion, blah, blah. That was not the way it was. It was totally the opposite.
Mm-hmm.
And I know we want to accept the old traditionalism.
Uh-huh.
We hate to give that up. But when this guy explained everything and how it was, all of a sudden it just made sense. I said, man, you know, David had all the, it was just like what we were talking about right then. He had the air power.
Yeah. Well, the sling, yeah, the sling isn't important.
He could stand 500 feet away, popping one of them stone. There was nothing Goliath could do about that.
Uh-huh.
I mean, it was like bringing a knife to a gunfight. I mean, David had the 45 and Goliath had the big long spear.
So we will, coincidentally, we are planning on talking about Goliath a little bit at the end of this week. He doesn't make an appearance, obviously. But there's a connection to this story. Yeah, the Philistines, yeah. We'll talk more about Goliath. I mean, he was physically very large. But let's move on to verse 10 and continue on in the chapter. Joshua turned back at that time and captured Hazor and struck its king with the sword, for Hazor formerly was the head of all those kingdoms. And they struck with the sword all who were in it, devoting them to destruction. There were none left that breathed. And he burned Hazor with fire. And all the cities of those kings and all their kings Joshua captured and struck them with the edge of the sword, devoting them to destruction, just as Moses, the servant of the Lord, had commanded. But none of the cities that stood on mounds did Israel burn, except Hazor alone. So that Joshua burned. And all the spoil of those cities and the livestock the people of Israel took for their plunder. But every person they struck with the edge of the sword until they had destroyed them, and they did not leave any who breathed. Just as the Lord had commanded Moses, his servant, so Moses commanded Joshua, and so Joshua did. He left nothing undone of all that the Lord had commanded Moses. All right, so this plays out almost exactly the same way as the battle against the Southern Coalition that we talked about last week and the week before. That you have this big fight with the army first, and then after that, Joshua goes on campaign and begins destroying all of these cities. So deal with the army first, then go for the cities. Here, we don't get a specific list of all of the cities that Joshua goes to in this northern campaign. The main focus is on the ringleader, the city of Hazor. And that is completely Harem, completely dedicated to destruction, so that not only are the people put to death, but the city also is burned down. So Hazor suffers the same fate as Jericho, completely destroyed. The rest of the cities, they just put the people to death, but the cities themselves are not burned down, and Israel is able to take the spoil. And again, the focus here is that Joshua and Israel continue to be in complete obedience to the Lord. That kind of phrase gets repeated a few times in this text, that they do just as Moses, the servant of the Lord, had commanded. And you get this, I like the way that the summary is stated there in verse 15. It works from top to bottom, right? Just as the Lord had commanded Moses, so Moses commanded Joshua, so Joshua did. Right? So that commandment gets passed down and gets fulfilled. This is a good picture of what obedience looks like. Is you pass the commandment down and fulfill the commandment that you were given. He left nothing undone of all that the Lord had commanded Moses. So there's not a whole lot to note here. I think, unless there are any questions or comments at this point, we are ready to go ahead and move on to the next passage and start to finish the chapter. Any questions or comments about the northern campaign? Again, it's dealt with pretty briefly in the text. So verse 16. So Joshua took all that land, the hill country, and all the Negev, and all the land of Goshen, and the lowland, and the Arava, and the hill country of Israel, and its lowland from Mount Halak, which rises towards Seir, as far as Baal Gad in the valley of Lebanon below Mount Hermon. And he captured all their kings and struck them and put them to death. Joshua made war a long time with all those kings. There was not a city that made peace with the people of Israel except the Hivites, the inhabitants of Gibeon. They took them all in battle. For it was the Lord's doing to harden their hearts that they should come against Israel in battle, in order that they should be devoted to destruction and should receive no mercy but be destroyed, just as the Lord commanded Moses. All right, so at this point, now that we finished up with the Northern Coalition and taking all of the northern cities, that northern campaign, now we essentially get what I like to think of as a montage. Right? You've all seen montages in film. A scene where you see a lot of action going on and it happens in very quick sequence, but it's giving you the sense that a lot of time is passing. You don't really get any dialogue or anything or any details. You're just seeing little snippets of what's going on. That's essentially what's happening here in the passage that we've just read. Because what the text is describing for us is not just the continuation of the northern campaign, but basically a summary of Joshua's continued conquest of the land. All right, so it starts off with descriptions of a lot of southern places in Israel. All right, the hill country, the Negev, in fact, Negev just refers to the southland. All the land of Goshen, the lowland and the Arba, and the hill country of Israel and all its lowland, from Mount Halak, which rises towards Seir. Now, Mount Seir is associated with Edom. Remember, Edom is on the southern border of Israel. So Mount Halak, we're referring to a southern extremity of the Promised Land. So his series of campaigns ranges all the way from Mount Halak as far as Baal Gad in the valley of Lebanon below Mount Hermon. All right, so we go from there to the northern extreme. In fact, you can see here Mount Hermon, like the one thing that this map has labeled clearly. So Joshua's campaigns are ranging this entire, at least from north to south. I'll put up a map for next week's lesson that shows kind of the total area that we read about Joshua conquering in this book. It's, don't think that this entire landmass, from the sea over to the edge of the map, from top to bottom, has been conquered. In fact, we're going to see in just the next passage that there is still a lot of territory that remains unconquered. But Joshua is ranging from north to south. He's all over the place, and he's doing exactly the same thing through this series of campaigns that he's been doing. He captures their kings, he strikes them and puts them to death. And then one of the things that we read that, again, really gives me the sense that we're looking at basically a montage is verse 18. Joshua made war a long time with all those kings. Now, up to this point, we've spent the first 10.5 chapters of Joshua reading about a relatively short period of time. Right? As we've read through, you've not gotten the sense that a whole lot of time has passed in between, say, Israel arriving on the plains of Moab, and then crossing the Jordan, and then conquering Jericho, and then going to battle against Ai, and dealing with Achan, and dealing with the Gibeonites, and then the Southern Coalition, and the Northern Coalition. We don't get any kind of indication across all of those chapters that we've got big breaks in time between those events. We're just moving straight from one thing to the next, to the next, to the next. And in fact, a lot of the plot hinges on somebody having heard what just happened in the previous chapter. Right, so we've had this long string of events from chapter 1 all the way up to this point. But now all of a sudden, we've hit a point in the story where the scope of the story really broadens out. We've got a summary here of a long time. That's what the text says. Joshua made war a long time with all those kings. Now, how long? The text doesn't tell us yet how long, if we're talking days, months, years. It's going to tell us, at least it's going to start to narrow in on something like a specific figure as we go through the book. We're going to learn, we'll get a broad sense of how long in chapter 13. I think we'll get something a little more specific in chapter 14 or chapter 15. So we will just, the only spoiler that I'll give here is that we're not talking about days, weeks, or months. We're talking about a years-long set of campaigns that are just summarized in a handful of verses. But by this point in the story, we know everything that we need to know about the shape of the story. Right? The whole premise of the story is that so long as Israel keeps to the covenant, God will give them the victory under any circumstances. Right? So they come up against a natural obstacle, like some water. Right? The river stops and lets them pass through because God's with them. Right? They come up to a fortified city to lay siege to it. God gives them that. They come up against a city that at first defeats them and has them running scared. But God ultimately gives them the victory in that. They come up against a coalition of Amorite kings. God gives them the victory there. They finally come up against this gigantic coalition that's, you know, armed with horses and chariots. And God gives them the victory there, too. I mean, we've, over these several battles and episodes that we've read in the book of Joshua, we've gotten like the full range of what ancient warfare looked like. Right? Little individual battles, ambushes, sieges, all kinds of things. You know, all the way up to major, major battles involving horses and chariots and all kinds of things. We've gotten the full flavor of it. And in every single circumstance, that central premise of the story holds true. So long as Israel obeys the covenant, God gives them the victory. So at this point, we don't need all of the details of the years-long campaign that Joshua wages in the land of Canaan, because it all plays out the same way. So long as Israel keeps the covenant, God is with them and gives them the victory. It does not matter what kind of circumstance they come up against. But then we read that there was not a city that made peace with the people of Israel except the Hivites, the inhabitants of Gibeon. They took them all in battle, for it was the Lord's doing to harden their hearts that they should come against Israel in battle, in order that they should be devoted to destruction and should receive no mercy but be destroyed, just as the Lord commanded Moses. So again, the story touches back on Gibeon. And again, we're reminded that, I know, when we read in verse 19, you know, there was not a city that made peace with the people of Israel except for the Hivites, the inhabitants of Gibeon. When we read that, if we've not sat down and thought about what's going on with Gibeon, we might think to ourselves, wait a minute, I didn't know that peace was an option. Right? You read Deuteronomy 7 and you read these other places where the Lord tells Moses in no uncertain terms, you will destroy all of these people. You're going to kill all of them. You're going to destroy their cities. You're not going to make a covenant with any of them. You're not going to make peace with any of them. Right? Based on that reading of the law, we're given the sense that peace is not an option with Israel. And yet, what have we learned from Gibeon? The same thing we learned from Rahab. Right? Peace was an option for these guys. But why did they not receive peace? Because ultimately, their hearts were hardened so that they came against Israel in battle. And here, of course, the text casts our minds back. Because obviously, whenever we read that the Lord hardens their hearts, besides learning that about these seven nations in the land of Canaan, who else obviously do we think about when we read about the Lord hardening someone's heart?
Pharaoh.
And when we were studying through Exodus, we spent some time talking about this. That the condition of Pharaoh's heart is not presented as simply as, God pulling the puppet strings on Pharaoh and deciding, okay, I want to nuke this guy for no reason. He's just an innocent little lamb, perfect, spotless Egyptian angel, but I've decided I'm going to nuke this guy. So I'm going to pull his puppet strings and he's not going to be able to say yes to those. Right. That's not the way it's presented in Exodus. That what precedes that is an act of hardening on Pharaoh's own part. Okay, we read that going both directions in the book of Exodus. Not just the Lord hardening Pharaoh's heart, but Pharaoh hardening Pharaoh's heart. And that's usually what comes first. And what God responds to is a softness or a hardness of heart that is already there. So, what do we find happening with the inhabitants of the land of Canaan? Because again, just if we were to just pluck this out of context, we might be tempted to think, the Lord is just pulling these puppet strings with these people, these perfect little Canaanite angels, and he just doesn't like them because he's a big meanie. And has decided that he's not going to let them make peace with Israel. He's not going to let them repent. But the thing is, we've got the example of Gibeon right there. Right? And we've got the example of Rahab close at hand as well. I want us to think through this, because this has been and this is the reason why I tend to repeat these kinds of things every time they come up. It can get tedious in the moment, but this, here's some payoff right here. We have seen how the book of Joshua has used hearing as a motif all through the story. Right? So-and-so heard this. Right? As soon as Israel crosses the Jordan, the Canaanites heard about it. And what was their response? Right? They heard that Israel was coming. And what was their response? Fear. Right? In the case of Jericho in particular, their response was, shut up the gates. Nobody in or out. Right? Their response to hearing what the Lord had done for Israel was resistance and rebellion. Right? Rahab makes that completely clear, by the way. Because what she tells the spies, she tells them specifically what everybody in Canaan has heard. She tells them what the people of Jericho have heard. They have heard about all that the Lord their God did for them in bringing them out of Egypt and guiding them through the wilderness. Right? They have heard the Hebrew version of the gospel. Right? The story of Israel being rescued out of Egypt and delivered to the promised land is foretelling the gospel. That's the gospel preached before the time of the gospel. Jericho heard it. Their response, close the gates. Rahab heard it. Her response, protect the spies and join up with Israel. Right? Ai also heard it. Their response was fight. Gibeon heard it. Again, we're talking about basically the same message here. Gibeon heard. And what was the response of Gibeon's hearing? They go out to make peace with Israel. They go out to cover their rear end, right? Adonizedek, the king of Jerusalem, hears. His response is to form a coalition. Jabin, the king of Hazor, hears. His response is to form an even bigger coalition. But this goes all through the story. Everybody hears and reacts. And the reaction is a big part of what's going on. It's like, Pharaoh hardening his own heart. and choosing to rebel. Before the Lord steps in and says, okay, if that's the decision that you're going to make, I'm going to hold you to it. The Gibeon makes peace with Israel, but none of the rest of them do because of the hardness of their hearts. All right, any questions or comments about all of that before we... I think we've got enough time to finish out the chapter. We got some cool stuff here. Yeah, God gave them over. And I think that's a good way, that's an easier way for us to understand what's going on. It's not that God is pushing somebody into something that they don't want to do. It's that God is giving them over into what is already the desire of their heart.
They're on predisposition.
Yeah.
They're on predisposition. So
yeah.
That's already good.
Yeah.
Okay.
So that's, I think that's a good connection.
Follow? I think an even bigger connection, and I think what it's kind of what Joshua, or well, it's really what Joshua, Judges, and then probably some of the minor prophets, and then ultimately Isaiah is preparing us for, is to see that Israel was responding freely to God, and then ultimately they ended up rejecting him anyways, constantly, and I got through patient and said, I will make these people, or I will make this people's heart hard. And
yes.
He said, it's interesting because it's like the culmination says, go and tell the people, this is after Israel's rebellion.
Yeah.
He said, be ever hearing but never understanding, be ever seeing but never perceiving.
Yeah.
Make the hearts of this people callous and deafen their ears and close their eyes. Otherwise, they might see with their ears and then he can follow up. And then it says, how long will it work? He says, until the city is vibrant, so it's off to the top of the temple.
Yes.
And so that's what Paul's talking about. He says, until the number of the Gentiles come in, and Israel will come back. So what we're seeing in the Gospels is the culmination of the Old Testament story, resulting in the hardening of Israel so that the Gentiles can come into the church because they are going to choose God.
And so we get, it's almost like we're reading the mirror image of it here.
Yes.
In that you've got Israel it's almost strange and uncanny how obedient and how willing they are in the book of Joshua. Like how on board with the Lord they are. And it's the Gentiles that are rebelling and just completely getting wrecked. And then you see the mirror image of that in the New Testament, where it's Israel that over the course of hundreds of years has grown strangely hardened to the Lord's will. And the Gentiles over the course of that time have become open to the Lord's will, so that Paul is able to travel all over the known world and make converts everywhere. So that's another really good connection. Excellent. All right, let's finish up chapter 11. We're starting verse 21. Try to keep this brief. Some cool stuff here, though. And Joshua came at that time and cut off the Anakim from the hill country, from Hebron, from Debir, from Anab, and from all the hill country of Judah, and from all the hill country of Israel. Joshua devoted them to destruction with their cities. There was none of the Anakim left in the land of the people of Israel. Only in Gaza, in Gath, and in Ashdod did some remain. So Joshua took the whole land according to all that the Lord had spoken to Moses, and Joshua gave it for an inheritance to Israel according to their tribal allotments, and the land had rest from war. All right, so we've reached a big conclusion here in the story. All right, the warfare part of this book is over. And in fact, that last verse prepares us for the next section of the book. Joshua gave the land for an inheritance to Israel according to their tribal allotments. That's going to be basically from here to the end of Book of Joshua is the tribal allotments. But the last thing that we read about Joshua doing in this warfare is taking out the Anakim. And you've heard that name before. You might not remember where from. But go back to Numbers chapter 13. Numbers chapter 13. And we'll just finish by reading the report of the spies. Verse 25. Numbers 13, 25. At the end of 40 days, they returned from spying out the land, and they came to Moses and Aaron and to all the congregation of the people of Israel in the wilderness of Paran at Kadesh. They brought back word to them and to all the congregation and showed them the fruit of the land. And they told him, "We came to the land which you sent us. It flows with milk and honey, and this is its fruit. However, the people who dwell in the land are strong, and the cities are fortified and very large. And besides, we saw the descendants of Anak there." In Hebrew, it's exactly the same word, by the way. Anakim means descendants of Anak. "The Amalekites dwell in the land of the Negev. The Hittites, the Jebusites, and the Amorites dwell in the hill country. The Canaanites dwell by the sea and along the Jordan." But Caleb quieted the people before Moses and said, "Let us go up at once and occupy it, for we are well able to overcome it." And the men who had gone up with him said, "We are not able to go against the people, for they are stronger than we are." So they brought to the people of Israel a bad report of the land they had spied out, saying, "The land through which we have gone to spy it out is a land that devours its inhabitants, and all the people we saw in it are of great height. And there we saw the Nephilim, the sons of Anak who come from the Nephilim. And we seemed to ourselves like grasshoppers, and so we seemed to them." When we're talking about the Anakim, we are talking about giants. And these are the guys who scared Israel off of the conquest in the first generation. These are the guys that made it so that Israel wandered for 40 years in the wilderness. And Joshua ends his conquest by going and killing them. Not quite all of them, because there are some who are left in Gaza, in Gath, that's significant, and in Ashdod. So, of course, here, who infamously comes from Gath?
Goliath.
So here we've got our Goliath connection. So, we will hit up chapter 12 next week. I think we're done with that passage. Yeah, so we'll hit up chapter 12 next week. Thank you so much for your kind attention and your questions and comments this morning. So let's head on out and get some fresh air. Any further questions or anything, we can just talk out on the porch.
Is this,